Welcome to Now. I'm David Byrd.
And I'm Manny Eck.
When you make an emergency call, does the person who answers speak your language?
We get pretty tense, especially if we know it's a medical call or this person that is in obvious distress.
There's a challenge on social media that has people shivering for a good cause.
What we've seen with the ice bucket challenge is it's probably a game changer for all of us in the fundraising world.
Street performers are fighting for their space in New York City.
Drive-in theaters once dotted the American landscape, but will they soon be a thing of the past?
We'll meet a Cambodian-American man who uses hip-hop to express his pain. That's all coming up on this Monday edition of Now. Manny, have you ever had to call 911 for an emergency?
Fortunately, I have not. What about you?
Well, I had to earlier this year. My neighbor's baby across the street was choking, and I don't speak Spanish, and she doesn't speak English, so I had to call 911 for her, and thank goodness the operator spoke Spanish, so they were able to give her instructions, and then the fire department came, and everything worked out okay.
Wow, that's so scary.
It was very scary.
How old was she?
The mother or the baby?
The baby.
The baby was like 3-4 months.
Oh, my.
Yeah, little tiny baby. Yeah, and she was choking, and the mom is panicking, of course. And I'm like, you know, the little girl runs up in the driveway. The second daughter runs up in the driveway. Please, can you take us to the hospital? I'm like,
I can't imagine that.
What's going on? And then it's like, you know, then it kind of goes, okay, you don't know anything, so call the people who do. So I did. I called 911, and they were able to help this woman. The baby's fine, the mother's fine, the older sister's fine, everything is fine, but it was scary.
Wow.
Yeah.
I'm glad you were able to help.
Yeah, you know, in the United States, dispatchers generally speak one language, English, but an increasingly multilingual society, some people in distress inevitably can't communicate in English, just like my neighbor.
Tom Bonzi takes us inside a 911 call center to find out what happens then.
The emergency call you're about to hear came into the Willamette Valley 911 Center in Salem, Oregon, but it could have been almost anywhere in America. A call in a foreign language is a daily or almost daily occurrence in urban counties.
911.
Bueno, es para mí.
So, do you have an emergency? Do you have an emergency?
Sí.
Okay, just a moment.
At this point, the dispatcher clicks a speed dial button to conference in an interpreter. Every 911 center in this part of the country has a contract with an emergency translation service like this.
Thank you for calling. What language?
Spanish.
Thanks for your operator number. One moment, please.
Thank you. Your call may be monitored or recorded.
On this call, it takes 55 precious seconds for the translator to come on the line.
We will be with you shortly.
Veteran call taker and training manager Andrea Tobin says the wait can be excruciating, though you can't hear it in the dispatcher's voice.
We get pretty tense, especially if we know it's a medical call or this person that is in obvious distress. When it's Spanish, it's pretty quick and easy for us to understand. When it's a different dialect, it becomes more complicated for us because we don't recognize them all. And then they put us on hold while they get an interpreter that is the language that we need. And that can sometimes be very quick. Sometimes it's 30 seconds or a minute.
Hi. My name is Luz. My ID is...
Spanish is by far the most common requested language for emergency translation, typically followed by Russian, Vietnamese, and Chinese dialects in varying order. Lately, call center supervisors in northwestern U.S. cities say they're seeing African and Middle Eastern languages crop up, a consequence of refugee inflows, perhaps. Translation companies such as Telelanguage and LanguageLine boast they have interpreters for 200 languages available. Willamette Valley 911 Director Mark Buchholz says having their interpreters on call is less expensive and easier than hiring bilingual operators. 3 of the 55 people on his staff who answer calls are certified bilingual, 2 in Spanish, 1 in Russian. Buchholz says centers like his actively recruit for bilingual call takers, but they're hard to find.
It's really tough to require a second language as a requirement to work for us. While it's important, we do pay a bonus. The volume isn't significant enough for us to have that an exclusive requirement for hiring.
At the Salem 911 Center, it's 3 minutes into the call from the running man. He says two men in a car are chasing him, possibly from the hospital. The call taker and interpreter go several rounds with him, trying to figure out where this is happening.
No, aquí estoy parado.
En la esquina de Lee Street y One Way.
Uh-huh.
Hey. I'm standing right on the corner of One Way and Lee Street.
We don't have One Way.
It took the trio another minute to figure out the intersection was actually Lee and 12th. Interpreters who join calls like this may be located halfway across the country. The companies they work for advertise this as a rewarding job that can be done from home. The same companies also translate for business call centers, banks, schools, and courts. In the case of our Salem emergency, a squad car rolls up to the scene before the call taker and interpreter get through the standard questions.
Do you see the officers?
¿Usted ya ve a los oficiales? Yeah.
Yes.
Can you stop and talk to them?
A piece of advice shared by several supervisors is to know how to say the name of your country and your native tongue in the local language wherever you go, just in case you need to call for help. For VOA News, I'm Tom Bonsi in Salem, Oregon.
So what about you? Have you ever called for help and not been understood?
Let us know your story by visiting our Facebook page, VOA Asia.
And you can email us your questions or comments at voaasia@voanews.com.
And be sure to follow us on Twitter at NowVOAShow.
The deadly disease amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, or ALS, is also known as Lou Gehrig's disease for the New York Yankees ballplayer who died from it.
In the U.S. alone, there are roughly 15 new cases of ALS diagnosed each day.
But there's a new social media campaign aimed at raising money for research into a cure.
As Arash Arabazadi tells us, the challenge has people dumping icy water on their heads across the country.
What a perfect day. The only thing that would make this better is if I had a big bucket of ice water dumped on my head right now.
By now, you've probably heard about the Ice Bucket Challenge. Basically, you dump ice water on your head. But first, you challenge others to follow suit. The stunt raises money to research the debilitating disease, amyotrophic lateral sclerosis.
Right now, we are running countrywide with both our chapters and the national organization at about $15.6 million.
Barbara Newhouse is president of the ALS Association. With help from this viral video campaign, the association has raised millions in just a few weeks, which means it can fund more research and help more families affected by the disease, families like the Lewises.
My father was diagnosed with Lou Gehrig's last November. The disease immediately started ripping through his system at a very fast pace, where his body deteriorated very quickly, and on April 27th, he passed away.
A few months later, the Ice Bucket campaign took off. His friends challenged him, but Lewis was on the fence.
I remember the last couple of weeks thinking I wasn't quite sure how I would feel if I was nominated. Three of my friends nominated me. I just thought this would be a great time just to, you know, advertise everything, you know?
So he took the Ice Bucket Challenge, and in the first 4 hours after he posted, Matt's video had raised more than $2,000. Barbara Newhouse says social media have changed the way nonprofits do business.
What we've seen with the Ice Bucket Challenge is it's probably a game changer for all of us in the fundraising world.
And Nikki Usher, an assistant professor at George Washington University, agrees.
And if you want to be able to be a player in the fundraising arena and to reach people that you haven't reached before, you have to reach people who you're not immediately going to be connected to. And one of the ways you do that is through social media.
Newhouse says the challenge now is to properly distribute the millions of dollars raised so far. Probably not the worst problem a nonprofit could have. And that gives hope to people like Matt Lewis.
Big fan of what everyone's been doing with that. It's raised a ton of awareness and a ton of money, and hopefully that will keep staying strong going forward.
The videos are everywhere, and they feature celebrities calling out everyone from their friends to President Barack Obama. While some videos are outright failures, for most, it's a fun way to raise awareness about a disease. But for some people, it means there's hope for the future and for a cure. Arash Arabasadi for VOA News.
Now, you haven't done this, right?
No, but it's everywhere on Facebook. I've seen my friends do that.
You know who else did it? President George W. Bush. Actually, Laura dumped the ice water on his head. They planned it out. But he was sitting there at the ranch in Texas with, mm-hmm. At the picnic table. And he's like, well, I don't think it would be presidential for me to. And all of a sudden, this water is like.
So he didn't know that was going to happen.
Well, no, he did.
Oh, he must have. Okay, it was a problem.
But he challenged Bill Clinton to do it. I haven't seen Bill Clinton do it yet.
Well, you know, I have a friend whose brother has ALS.
Yes.
And he was also on a local TV station.
Right.
Where he was dumped.
Really?
Yeah.
The brother or the guy with ALS?
The guy with ALS.
Really?
Yeah. So it's awesome.
It's a thing. You know, I hear they've raised, the last figure I saw was $23 million, but it's more than that now. Because when people dump this bucket on their head, they're also giving $100 to the ALS Foundation.
Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's the challenge.
I wonder how they manage that.
I don't know.
There's a lot of videos out there.
There's a lot of videos out there, including of this story. So if you want to see it, log on to our webpage, www.voanews.com.
And let us know your thoughts by visiting our Facebook page, VOA Asia.
And have you taken this challenge? Let us know by following us on Twitter at NowVOAShow.
Tomorrow way too far away, and we can get back yesterday. But we young right now, we got right now, so get up right now, 'cause all we got is right now.
Manny, you've been to New York, right? You ever ride the subway?
Yes, I have many times, but not to nitpick, but I think the metros in D.C. are much cleaner.
Well, they are. But now, did you see some of the street performers there
in
New York City?
All the time. I think it's a great venue if you're a new artist to be discovered.
You know, you can hear anything from a Mozart chamber concerto to rap to jazz on some subway platforms. But recently, turns out those performers are finding it harder to make a living.
The arrests of public performers or buskers have increased drastically from a year ago.
That's largely the result of the new City Police Commissioner William Bratton's broken windows policing strategy that assumes targeting low-level crimes will deter more serious crime.
VOA's Tala Hadavi met with a couple of performers to find out more.
These performers are with Waffle Life Entertainment. They've been dancing in New York City subway trains since 2007, making more than $100 each per day. They say dancing and entertaining otherwise bored subway riders has kept them out of trouble. But now, they are getting into trouble. And the charges are serious, reckless endangerment.
Now, cops trying to crack down on it, and it just stops our living, We're not here to hurt anybody. We're not here to steal from anybody.
Matthew Christian is a violinist and has performed in public since he was a child in Vermont. It was natural for him to seek out the city's busker scene when he moved here, but he ran into problems right away.
Actually, the second day that I performed after I'd come to New York, I was arrested wrongfully. I was playing at Spring Street, following the MTA rules, and I was quite suddenly arrested by an undercover police officer.
The 30-year-old Metropolitan Transit Authority handbook Matthew is showing does state that artistic performances on the platform and mezzanine are allowed. Yet, this year, almost 300 artists, like Andrew Sanders, have been arrested.
I just had to pay a fine. Basically, all that could have been avoided if I just had to pay a fine from the start. And I'm sitting in a jail cell with criminals that's really criminals.
Saunders and his crew say they are aware they're not supposed to perform on the train, but they believe the charges are too harsh.
We don't have a platform to really express ourselves through dance. So it's just like, it's either we take the risk or we just don't do it at all.
It's a penalty that, according to the law, is for people who create a serious possibility of injuries including death or permanent disability or disfigurement. And we see that as being just incredibly extreme.
Both the harsh charges against the dancers and the allegedly wrongful ejections and arrests of buskers on the platforms spurred Christian to start Busk NY, an organization advocating for street performers. The community gathered at City Hall to protest the recent crackdowns and raise awareness about the MTA rules.
I'd like to see a New York in the future where, first, everyone is aware that performance is legal. Second, that people continue to love performance, and maybe that more people than ever do use this opportunity to perform in public.
But for now, he says, he will continue educating and advising Andrew Sanders and the rest of the city's community about their rights. So far, about 12 lawsuits have been filed, and he says he expects more in the coming months. Tala Hadavi, VOA News, New York City.
For a video version of this story, be sure to visit our website, www.voanews.com.
And let us know your thoughts by visiting our Facebook page, VOA Asia.
Be sure to follow us on Twitter. We're at Now VOA Show.
So, David, what was the last movie you saw?
In the theater, I took my nephew to see the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
Was it in a multiplex?
Yes, it was a 3D thing, so the turtles are, like, leaping out of the screen and stuff. So
let me ask you this. When was the last time you saw a movie in a drive-in theater?
Gosh. Oh, man. It's been since I was a kid, so it was probably 40 years ago, something like that. Maybe
Four decades?
Well, yes.
I'm just doing my math.
Before you were born.
Yes, thank God. Drive-in movies used to be a staple of the American landscape, but now they are rare, especially as more theaters change from film to digital technology.
As VOA's Kane Farabaugh tells us now, old-school movie theaters are relying on new-age social media to keep them relevant and in business.
The setting sun over LaSalle County, Illinois, on a Friday evening.
We got three kids and one adult.
Signals the beginning of a 60-year tradition, familiar to those who frequent this increasingly rare and iconic American landmark.
At one time, there was 5,000 drive-ins. Right now, there's about 388 left.
The popular Route 34 drive-in attracts hundreds of moviegoers who fill a two-hectare lot full of vehicles most weekend nights in the summer. Ron Magnoni first started working here in 1987. In 1994, he bought the drive-in, which he says has survived more than just time.
That's the third screen right there behind me. The first one blew down. The second one, half of it blew down when they were running a movie. And I had a tornado here. It almost took mine down again.
But what the tornado did not claim, technology might. The magic behind the movies Magnoni shows on his massive outdoor screen is an antiquated relic, a 35-millimeter film projector built in the 1950s. It is becoming obsolete as more companies stop distributing movies by celluloid and switch to digital formats. Which means to keep the Route 34 drive-in open, Magnoni needs to upgrade.
The machine that I need costs $70,000. I don't have the kind of resources that these big chains have.
It is a problem many independent theater owners face as the move to all digital theaters marches on. The digital upgrade threatens architecturally unique and historically significant structures, like Dmitry Kovalis's patio theater in Chicago.
The patio theater is an old school classic movie palace from a bygone age where you don't see many of these theaters left, not only in Chicago, but in the whole country.
But the quality of what they are watching now at the patio theater is different, thanks to a loyal fan base and the internet.
At the time, there was no other theater that used something like Kickstarter, which is a crowdfunding website to get pledges and money from fans to basically finance a piece of equipment.
Thanks to backers who pledged more than $50,000, the patio theater now has a digital projector, ensuring its future. Most movie companies plan to stop distributing film by next year. Kane Farabaugh, VOA News, Earlville, Illinois.
To see video of Kane's story, visit our webpage, www.voanews.com.
And let us know your opinion by visiting our Facebook page, VOA Asia.
Be sure to follow us on Twitter, too. We're at Now VOA Show. Manny, you're originally from Cambodia, right?
Yes, but I left Cambodia when I was about 3 or 4. So.
3 or 4.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay. Now, obviously, hip-hop music wasn't part of your growing up experience.
When I was in the refugee camp, we grew up listening to the oldies.
The oldies?
Like the artists like Phil Collins. No, Phil Collins. Oh. Lionel Richie, The Carpenters, that's who I listened to for
really?
A very long time.
Oh,
and I still
cool.
listen to them.
Really?
Yes.
Wow. Okay. Well, you know, Elizabeth Lee introduces us now to a man from Cambodia who uses hip-hop to express his struggles and to reach out to other survivors of the Cambodian genocide.
I'm a new breed, some they never suck.
At 36 years old, Chanty Sok, known to his friends as CS, has experienced more than most people in a lifetime. As a hip-hop artist, he tells his story of pain and redemption.
My struggle was coming from a war-torn country, single mother who's probably suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder, raising 6 kids living in somebody else's living room. That struggle was real.
His mother brought the family to Long Beach, California, where he experienced poverty, bullying, and prejudice.
It was just basically the simple rules. Go to school, stay away from trouble. If somebody hurts you, look the other way and get home. Those are the rules. But when you leave the household, it's a whole different story. Those rules don't apply. You can't run from the bullies forever. You can't run from racial slurs forever.
Without support from home or his mother, CS joined a gang, was convicted of armed robbery, and sentenced to 11 years in prison.
Ain't nobody loved me at home, so I felt like I'm gonna go out. And whatever pain that was inflicted on me, it's gonna be easy for me to reflect on other people. Because my mama, that's my life though. But I'm just glad that I got out of prison. Not the criminal, you know what I'm saying? Not the tainted background, not the tainted individual.
While in prison, CS says he had time to think and finally understood his mother's struggles. He also found a way to give voice to his pain through rap music. More than a year after he was released, CS continued to work on his music, and he ended up on the cover of an arts and entertainment newspaper in Los Angeles. He is one of a growing number of Cambodian Americans using hip-hop to express themselves because it is the music of the urban communities where they grew up.
We're not saying we're the best representation for Cambodians. We're not. I think that I'm the best representation for the people who went through the struggle like me, for the people who didn't have a voice like me.
A lot of these artists do their music as if it's a sense of duty, as if this is their way to pay respect to the survivors, to the victims of the genocide.
Sig Smith produced the Cambodian Music Festival this month in Los Angeles, bringing together artists from around the United States.
This is their piece of the voice that they can project to the world.
Smith says, as with any music of the younger generation, hip-hop is not embraced by everyone in the community.
There are older generation Cambodians here in the U.S. as well as in Cambodia who really don't like the representation of Cambodian hip-hop, feeling like it brings some kind of negative vibe to the culture and losing its tradition.
Beyond talking about his own struggles in his songs, CS is working on infusing traditional Cambodian music into his work. Smith says many artists not only want to get in touch with their roots, but are trying to connect with musicians in the Cambodian diaspora, locally and around the world, so the artists can have a voice again after the horrors of the genocide. Elizabeth Lee for VOA News, Long Beach.
To see video of this story, visit our website, www.voanews.com.
And let us know your thoughts or questions by visiting our Facebook page, VOA Asia.
Be sure to follow us on Twitter, too. We're at Now VOA Show. Thanks for joining us for this Monday edition of Now.
If you have any questions or comments, you can email us at voaasia@voanews.com.
Or you can visit our Facebook page, VOA Asia.
And be sure to follow us on Twitter at NowVOAShow.
If you want to hear our show again, visit www.voanews.com/now. We're also on iTunes.
Patrice Martin produces our program.
The managing editor of VOA English is Diane Gao. Until tomorrow, I'm David Byrd.
And I'm Manny Eck.
Join us again for another edition of Now.